Tell me, Steve-erino, did it ever occur to you that we don't need another car?
It's not just a car, honey. It's a piece of history. A 289 with dual carbs and a pony interior.
Steve, where did you learn to talk like that?
Hey, come on, honey. After all, I was a guy before I met you.
Nice to spend these father-son moments together, Dad.
Shut up. I'm trying to read. Oh, great. This is Japanese. Oh, here we go. Achtung, ihr habt die Kopf. These aren't instructions. It's the history of World War II. Oh, here it is. Attention, vous avez. Oh, hell. More people we should have killed.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
It's okay, Marcy. Come on. I'll take you home.
Yes, home. Where Perry Como sings and Santa's still alive.
Is Santa okay? We heard he landed in your yard.
Yeah!
Oh, yes. He's fine. He's a fat, jolly man, and he'll never leave us. As long as there's a Christmas, there'll be... Killers!
Beam me up a burger, Bundy. Warp speed.
People out there dying for kangaroo, huh?
That's right. Tell the world, Bundy. You didn't make the noise, Bundy.
Whoosh!
Thank you! Thank you, thank you. You've been a wonderful audience. But now it's time to kill some people and marry the princess. Any objections, you seagoing weenie?
Kill him, Paco. Rip his guts out. Show him what I mean to you, baby.
I would, but I'm wearing my good clothes. Besides, I am strangely attracted to this.
This girl! This girl! Who wants to see?
Fellas, fellas, now, what are we fighting about? Here we are in the playground of the gods. We got bimbos on the tube, we got the law on the floor, we got sugar on our nuts. And we got our wives at the Jeffersons. Who gives a rat's patoot who was in the first light beer commercial?
He's right!
Yeah!
Especially since we all know it was Bubba Smith!
Oh my God, that's my ex-husband!
That's Steve!
For our next spontaneous question, Dean, was it your impressive resume that got you this job, or your penetrating blue eyes?
It was a ragu of eyes and resume with a dash of rapier wit.
Can you believe that tomorrow is our 5-year high school reunion? I mean, that means we've been out of school for years.
I hear people are coming from all over for this reunion.
Mm-hmm. Even foreign countries like Indiana.
Indonesians are coming? We better brush up on our Spanish.
Oh. Well, since we're stuck here, we might as well play Mad Libs, okay? I need a verb.
Clock?
Okay. Somebody give me a command.
Cluck you?
I like you.
You know, perhaps Mad Libs is just a little too advanced for you people, so let's just play 20 questions, okay? Who'll ask the first question?
Go to hell.
That's not a question.
Why don't you go to hell?
I really like you.
This is Richard German, writer and producer of Married with Children, and you are listening to the Married with Children podcast.
Let's rock.
Thanks, Dad.
Can I get a whoopin?
Whoa, buddy!
No Man presents, live from the nudie bar, the Married with Children podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, and Married with Children fans worldwide,
We have gathered back today to talk to somebody who was with Married with Children from its start with the unaired original pilot in late 1986 through to the end of season 10. And he also wrote the first episode of season 11. So if there's one person who can tell us the complete story of Married with Children, please welcome to the Married with Children podcast, Mr. Richard Gurman.
Nice to be here.
The Richard has a new book out. It comes out on the 23rd of April, and it's called Married with Children versus the World, the inside story of the shock-com that launched Fox and changed TV comedy forever. And this book is the definitive inside story that you need to add to your Married with Children collection. And just like episodes of the show, you'll want to read this book over and over again. And this book has been reviewed and endorsed by Ed O'Neill, Katie Segal, David Garrison, and Michael G. Moy. Richard has worked in Hollywood for over 35 years, writing, producing, and showrunning such popular TV shows as Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Mork and Mindy, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, Still Standing, and of course, Married with Children. In 2017, he produced the documentary film This Is Bob Hope for the PBS series American Masters. And in 2020, along with director John Sheinfeld, he executive produced the documentary The Happy Days of Gary Marshall for ABC. And according to IMDb, Richard has writing credits across 21 shows, producer credits on 15 shows, and has also been creative consultant and story editor. Richard holds a bachelor's degree in sociology and a master's degree in journalism from the University of California at Berkeley. And I'm sure there's even more credits than IMDb would let on. So Richard has written by credits on a total of 17 Married with Children episodes. So we've got season 1, episode 5, Have You Driven a Ford Lately? Season 1, episode 6, 16 Years and What Do You Get? Season 1, episode 13, Johnny Be Gone. Season 2, episode 7, For Whom the Bell Tolls. Season 2, episode 13, You Better Watch Out. Season 3, episode 8, The Gypsy Cried. Season 3, episode 14, A Three-Job, No-Income Family. Season 7, episode 3, Every Bundy Has a Birthday. Season 7, episode 18, Peggy and the Pirates. Season 8, Episode 4, Luck of the Bundys. Season 8, Episode 10, Dances with Wheezy. Season 9, Episode 5, Business Sucks, Part 1. Season 9, Episode 24, Radio Free Tremaine. Season 10, Episode 2, A Showroom with a View. Season 10, Episode 8, Blonde and Blonder. Season 10, Episode 22, Enemies. And Season 11, Episode 1, Twisted. That is an incredible list, Richard, and it's very varied, and there's a lot of titles there that are going to jump out at people, and I cannot wait to talk about some of these.
Okay.
I guess we start at the beginning. So if you just please tell us a little bit more about yourself, like where are you from originally, where you grew up, and what actually made you want to be a television writer?
Well, I grew up in Pasadena, California, sort of a conservative Southern California community. And I went to school at UC Berkeley, where I got a master's degree in journalism after I got a bachelor's degree in sociology. And I studied documentary filmmaking was my specialty in journalism school. And I came to Los Angeles all serious about doing a documentary career. I interviewed for a bunch of jobs, and one of the jobs I interviewed for turned out to be assistant to the producer of a show called The Partridge Family, which was a popular sitcom at the time, starring David Cassidy about a family rock and roll band. And it was the only place I got a job. So I thought, what the heck, I'll take the job, I'll come to LA, and then I'll start my documentary career later. Well, it turned out to be much later, because what happened was I came to Los Angeles, I got a job on the show, and I loved working on situation comedy. And I started feeling that that could be my career. So then I did what every aspiring sitcom writer does, write a spec script. And mine was a Happy Days. And it got me a job with the legendary Gary Marshall, who had created Laverne and Shirley, Happy Days, Mork and Mindy, went on to be just a huge filmmaker, Pretty Woman, all kinds of great films. And he had this apprenticeship program where writers like myself, who are just aspiring, would come into the system and they would just watch and participate in the shows he was doing. So here I was, this kid right out of college or a couple of years thereafter, and I was watching Henry Winkler and Ron Howard and Cindy Williams and Penny Marshall and Ronald Williams on a daily basis. And it was just mind-blowing, and it was all towards learning a craft and learning a career, which I did under Gary. So I worked as an apprentice under him, and then I became a writer on Laverne and Shirley, where I met Ron Levitt, who was executive producer at the time.
Laverne, please, buck up, would you?
I'm trying, sure, but I can't. I mean, you know how much I hate flying in a plane?
Yes.
Well, it's nothing compared to I hate jumping out of one. Oh, gee, I'm getting a bad case of the monkey nerves, Cheryl. I can feel it.
No, fight it. Fight it, all right. Fight it. Don't embarrass us in front of these people. Fight it.
Well, you girls are about to do a 5,000-foot swan dive. Hope them chutes open.
And I worked on Happy Days.
Hey.
Oh, no.
What are you, a black lover?
As a matter of fact, I am a black lover. And a Jew lover, and a Protestant lover. I love cowboys, I love Indians.
It's true. He's the biggest lover in Milwaukee.
Well, you're gonna love this.
Oh, yes, I am. Oh, Lance, yes.
Hold it. This is a non-violence thing.
A what?
Non-violence.
What a great time to tell me that.
Eleanor, just sit down over there and shut up. The sheriff is coming.
Maybe.
Oh, that's just saving myself a lot of trouble. These jokers start busting plates over your head. Who do you think gets to clean it up?
And a bunch of other shows. And then eventually, I hooked up with Ron Levitt later on at the beginning of Married with Children. So that's sort of my backstory.
That's so cool. So were you around Happy Days when Ted McGinley joined the cast?
Hey, Raji, let's go and step on it.
Hey, Fonz, I can't believe you're going to help me find an apartment. You know, meeting you has truly turned out to be serendipitous.
Serendipitous, adjective, derived from the faculty of finding things valuable that's not sought for. All right.
He had already joined the cast, but I met him. I knew him as any writer would know an actor, because you go to run-throughs together, you go to the show together, and he was just a great, great force for good. And I knew him a little, but I didn't know him like I knew him once he was on Married with Children.
Yeah, it's just that he said something similar about Gary Marshall, that Gary Marshall was very good at spotting talent.
Yes.
And it was just a lovely guy and just great to work with.
Yeah, and I was happy to honor him by doing a documentary about him, sort of in my way giving back, just as this book, in a way, is my way of giving back to Married with Children that gave so much to me.
Oh, I love that. So as I mentioned, IMDb is not always 100% accurate or complete, and so you've written for a lot of iconic shows. So are there other shows that haven't been mentioned already?
I don't think so. There are a lot of shows you work on as a TV writer. I mean, the public knows the big shows, the ones that lasted, but there's a lot of shows that we call like six and out.
Mm.
They're on the air for six and then they're gone, and it may or may not show up in your credits. So I think the IMDb is pretty accurate in my case.
Oh, good. So one of those shows we mentioned was The Facts of Life. Can you share with our listeners why The Facts of Life drove you to Levitt and Moyer in 1986, and really, were you the source of all those lighthearted jabs that Married with Children took at The Facts of Life?
Okay, well, I'll start at the beginning. I was hired to be an executive producer on The Facts of Life, which was a really big career move for me. At the time, actually, Levitt and Moy were on a development deal at the same studio. It was the legendary Embassy, Norman Lear Studio. So I was running the show on Facts of Life, and it was my first time as a showrunner, and that's a big career move. It's a big deal. And I kind of ran afoul of the girls, the facts of life. You know, it's about four girls at a boarding school. And there was one particular episode that we wrote that we wanted them to do, where one of their fathers gets involved in an insider trading scandal, and it affects the girl, the character named Blair.
I'll get it.
Blair, Blair, you're not going to jail.
Of course she's not. Her father is.
People like Blair's father don't go to jail. They go to fenced-in dude ranches where they got tennis courts, gourmet meals.
Joe, you're not helping.
Okay, so we'll send them a file and a quiche.
Oh. Why am I getting so worried? Nothing is going to happen. My father will take care of everything.
Yeah, he's done a great job so far.
What do you mean?
Doesn't it bother you that he made you the patsy? He stuck you with this mess.
You just have it in for my father because he's rich and successful.
And cheating the government.
It's not cheating. It's business.
And the arc of the story is that it affects her, makes her kind of go lock herself in the room. And then through her friendship with her other girls, she comes out and she realizes it was her father, it wasn't her. So she's not feeling guilty about it. Well, they really didn't want to do the episode. They felt it cast their character in a bad light and that it was not consistent with the series. Being sort of new and fresh at it, I stood up for myself. Maybe later on I would have caved. And I insisted that they do it, and then I insisted that they do it my way. Well, they did, but it drove a wedge between myself and the cast. We never got along after that, and it was really just kind of uncomfortable. I decided I was going to quit. So I walked off the show, and I found myself proud to have stood up for myself and quit, but without a job and with family and a mortgage. Around that same exact time, Ron Levitt and Michael Moy had written the pilot for Married with Children, and they knew I was out of work. They knew I was looking for a job, and I had worked with Ron before, like I said, on Laverne and Shirley. So he handed me the script, and he said, "What do you think?" And I read it, and it just blew my mind. It was so, well, as your audience knows, it was so different than any of the other shows out there, particularly the one I was just coming off of. So I said, sure, I'll do it. My only concern was I had no idea whether it would get on the air because it was so different.
You know, another thing that makes women such a blessing to us, it's like when you're sitting somewhere and they come over and they say to you, "What are you thinking?" And you start thinking, you know, if I wanted you to know, I'd be talking. But you can't actually say that to them or else they'll kill you. And they're allowed, too. See, it's this whole period, PMS thing. I know, I'm not a doctor. But I think that PMS stands for pummel men's scrotums. Does your wife buy you juice, Steve?
I mean, at the time, we're talking about Cosby and Family Ties and Different Strokes, and, you know, Facts of Life, you know, all these shows that were on the air and popular. I had no idea how it would do. But that turned out to be the point of the whole thing, was to go up against that. So, yes, quitting the Facts of Life had everything to do with me being put in touch with Levitt and Moy and ending up on Married with Children. And yeah, the shots that the show took effects of life, I was the source of many of those, proudly.
You don't have to pay for those albums, Al. The law says that if you get something you didn't order, not only do you not have to pay for it, but you can keep it and use it. That's how we got that Facts of Life talking scale.
Oh, that's so cool, because I figured out after the fact that Facts of Life and Married with Children shared a production company back when it was NBC Communications. So I thought it was cross-promotion, if nothing else.
Well, Norman Lear was not there when Married with Children was born, but,
no,
you know, Norman Lear had many, many shows and, you know, was very innovative. Facts of Life happened to be sort of in the old camp. I mean, after all, Norman did Archie Bunker and Maude. Mm. and all of that. So yeah, it did share a production company, but they didn't care that I was taking shots at them. They didn't care.
No, I like that. So what made you want to write what is effectively a history of Married with Children, especially at this point? Because there has been some recent reinterest in the show lately, in the last couple of years. There's always rumors of a reboot. People want a reunion of some sort. But at this point, the show premiered 37 years ago. And we are fortunate that the main cast and many of the background people are still with us. So it's full of first-hand accounts and recollections. It's not just a book about the show, but it's a history of sitcom television from that era and of the Fox network. Is that what inspired you?
We share a similarity. I mean, you guys wanted to create a legacy for the show. And I wanted to tell the story and I wanted to honor it. Because of my insider's point of view, I felt that the story of the making of the series would be funny and in some ways as outrageous as the show itself, and that fans would like that. As I started writing it, though, it became clear that the whole launching of the Fox network and of using Married with Children as an outrageous show to capture viewers from the other networks is based on a premise that people don't know about today, which is older people do, but younger people is that TV was this, I had to tell the story of what TV was like in the 80s and the 90s, which is the idea that it's linear, that it wasn't just, you just couldn't sit down like you can now with streaming and watch what you want when you want it. You had to compete with the other shows that were in your time slot. So the whole idea behind Fox launching a new network and using Married with Children as the cornerstone was to do something different to attract viewers who were otherwise watching Cosby or Family Ties or Who's the Boss or whatever. So I felt I needed to backtrack without getting too academic and give that context so that viewers would know kind of why Married stood out so much during that time and why there was such an effort to make it such a counter sitcom.
So I love the title of the book, Married with Children versus the World, the inside story of the shock-com that launched Fox and changed TV comedy forever.
Right.
I like the word shock-com. Can you go through our listeners the structure of the book?
I start with sort of the historical impact of the show, how it influenced so many other shows and that came after it, and Roseanne and The Simpsons and Family Guy and so on and so forth, and how it's still in syndication today, and how the actors are still in demand and huge in other series, and things like your podcast that, you know, it's still in the vernacular. It's still relevant. And so I start off sort of making that case. And then also, like I said, the whole idea that Fox was starting a new network and they wanted to do something different. So they used Married with Children to be the sort of cornerstone of doing the symbol of different.
Broadcasting Company. Introducing the Bundys of Chicago, a family like you've never seen.
Mom, Dad,
you're grounded.
Al Bundy, a real man's man.
Now I'm going to watch the news, and when it's over, I want some form of dead animal on my plate.
His lovely wife, Peggy.
Don't mind Al. It's just his time of the month.
They're two wonderful children.
You're disgusting. And you're failing 5 classes.
And their newlywed neighbors.
I love you, Marcy.
I love you, Steve.
I hate them, Peg.
They hate you, Al.
They're not the Cosbys. They're the Bundys. And they're Married with Children.
And then from there, I dive into just the chronology of it. The first part of it is the casting in the show, which is very contentious. And I don't know whether your podcast audience knows or not, but there was a very good chance that Ed O'Neill was not going to be Al Bundy. There was a big fight over that. And so I thought that the audience would be interested in that. In fact, that fight, I got a call from Ed O'Neill after he read the book And I detail that fight in quite detail. And he was aware that he wasn't the first choice of the network, but he was not aware of how precarious that position was and how the show almost didn't happen because he was our choice. So I think that fans will be interested in that too. Then I focus on the first kind of three seasons of the show, finding out kind of what's the our process of finding out what was going to work best for the characters. And we were struggling. People don't know we had very low ratings. We happen to have decent ratings for Fox, but in the general scheme of things versus the other networks, the ratings were still very low. And then along came this sponsor boycott. This woman in Michigan named Terry Ricolta in the third season decided that she didn't like the show and she thought it was an offense to America. And sort of like almost everything we were doing, everything we were trying to do, she was opposed to. And she, it was pretty amazing that she got to the biggest sponsors, Colgate-Palmolive, Coca-Cola, the Tama brands and so on. And she got them to withdraw their sponsorship. And so I talk about how that played out and how it eventually played into the hands of Married with Children because the publicity that she was on the front page of the New York Times, she was on Nightline, she was on the morning shows, and the publicity made people go to the show and watch it, and they stayed there.
You know, the problem is that you can't sit there and anticipate what's going to happen. You have no idea all of a sudden what's going to happen. It's shock TV. And it's
are you there, caller? Hi.
Yeah, Terry.
Go ahead.
Terry, I just wanted to say that I respect you very much for the stand that you've made. However, it's my understanding that the ratings to Married with Children have increased tremendously since all the publicity. I think.
Well, I'm waiting for them to send me a fruit basket.
she doesn't deny that that's happened. I don't know whether that necessarily means then that, you know, her effort should be swept aside as unimportant. Are you there? Hi.
So that was kind of a make or break point, and I wanted to emphasize that a lot in the structure of the book. That was at that point. The next big thing that happened on the show structurally, and that's how I follow it in the book, is David Garrison leaving. David Garrison left, as maybe you know or you don't know, on his own. I mean, he really wanted to go back and have a Broadway career. He was kind of tired of his commuting to Los Angeles, and he ended up having a Broadway career. And it was not a contentious split up at all. Ron and Michael loved David.
The producers gave Garrison a sentimental send-off.
They gave me a huge photograph. It was actually a mugshot from one episode where Steve had been arrested. With a bloody lip. It was a mugshot, and they wrote across it, and you're going to have to bleep this for your audience. Gotta sing, gotta dance, gotta fucking starve to death.
But his leaving created this huge vacuum because, and I talk about this in the book, he helped define Ed. He was a target for Ed. Here's this yuppie banker, and here's Ed, this lowly shoeman. It became a huge focus for jokes, for stories, and so on. And with him gone, that was dispelled, and it sort of became Al Bundy versus the world. At that point, you can look at the whole series and you can look at it getting broad, and there are a variety of reasons all series kind of get broader as they go on. But that was a key reason that the show became Al Bundy versus the world, because he no longer had just David Garrison to bitch about and what Garrison represented. So that's the next part of the book. And then Ted McGinley comes in, and that relationship is different.
Now, Jeff, all kidding aside, run. Run hard, run now, run silent, run deep. Run like Mexican water through a first-time tourist, but the key word here is run.
Don't you think she's cute, Al?
Run.
It's just that I can hardly believe I'm now Mrs. Darling, what's your last name?
Darcy.
Marcy Darcy? I'm now Marcy Darcy? What have I done? Maybe I should start wearing little dresses with dots on them.
And opens things up, and he becomes more of a friend to Al. And that's really a fun relationship to have. And so I go into that. And then the other thing that happened that I talk about, and I don't know how well publicized this is, and I didn't want to make this a tabloid kind of a story, but there was friction within the actors themselves, within our core group, and particularly between Ed O'Neill and Amanda Burse. I don't know if the readers know, your viewers or listeners. No, but Amanda started directing a lot of episodes, and she was a terrific director. In fact, I used her on other sitcoms when I left. But the relationship between her and Ed changed vis-a-vis, she went from being the neighbor and not even the family, just the neighbor next door, a very, very important, critical character, to being the person who was in charge on the set, who told the actors what to do and how to do it. And this caused friction between them and sort of created an internal dynamic that became part of us as producers, it rubbed off on us. We had to manage that. And I talk about that. And both Ed and Amanda have been very, very open and free about talking about what went wrong, why it went wrong, how it could have been different, and so on. And I talk about that a lot in the book. From then on, it just becomes, and anyone who follows the show knows, and I know you guys talk about it, it went from being sort of this kind of reality-based, grounded, blue-collar, married, working man guys show to just this cartoon, honestly, is, you know, very, very big and very broad. And some of it has to do with what I mentioned, the David Garrison exit and that Ed no longer had a focus. And some of it has to do with what happens on almost every single show, is that you run out of sort of your grounded premise, and they have dreams where they go to the moon, or they have, you bring in characters. And I point out in the book, even Frasier and even Friends, you know, had their kind of wild moments. And I focus on that. But I also want to emphasize, when people write about the series, sometimes they talk about, and correctly, they talk about the more grounded part of it, and you guys have to, and the broader part of it. But I would maintain, without apologizing, you know, some of the broad part was not good, but I would maintain that some of the broad part was just as stellar as anything in the grounded part, because it paid off. Alan falling off the roof, and yeah, it's too broad to believe a guy's going to fall off the roof on his head and walk into the next scene to have an argument with his wife. But if it's really well done, it pays off. And I think that it's a testament to Married that even during the broad, silliest of their shows, they made them paid off, and they had fun. So that's basically the structure of it. It breaks down some of the episodes, not all of them. It breaks down some of the guest casting. It also has little sections about little, like Amanda Burse going into flights of fancy and having orgasms on the screen.
Peggy, a lot of people think they saw Elvis. He was an idol, a sex symbol. And with men what they are today, is it any wonder we look to the dead for a little excitement? Believe me, Peggy, no one wishes you were alive more than I do. I've been to Graceland. I saw him in Vegas. His buns alive with magic. His voice pulsing through me, reaching my secret places. His hips undulating, swirling, grinding, driving his essence into my very soul again and again. Faster and faster until... Can I have a cigarette? Anyhow, what I'm saying here is Elvis is dead, and we should get on with our lives. Oh, God.
Do you realize that you just had more sex today in this house than I've had in 16 years of marriage? And it lasted longer.
kid complaining about coming home from work.
The gods must be on a roll, huh? Must be playing another round of Can You Top This? Then to start out, let's make him a shoe salesman. Another one said, let's give him a redhead. Another one, probably a cruel hungover god, said, I know, let's have him not eat, yet not starve.
Yes, Daddy, but the gods showed you they loved you when they gave you us.
Yeah, well, give them gods a Miller.
You know, all the athletic stuff.
Come on, Al, I mean, surely you've got something else from your football days to leave to your son?
I do. My game ball. From the greatest day in anyone's lifetime. The day that I scored 4 touchdowns. Yeah. My game ball. That is what I shall leave to my only son, the carrier of the Bundy seed and name. And from the looks of things, the last.
It breaks those things down too. So I think fans will, there's fan-driven stuff all along the way too that I sprinkle throughout.
I think fans are going to love this book, and by which I mean casual fans, but also, say, fans like us, the more hardcore fans who might know more than the casual fan, but are still going to get something out of this. So we might know a bit about the background about the casting, but you mentioned how precarious it was for Ed O'Neill to be cast, and was cast quite late and seemingly at the last minute almost, and he could have been played by Sam Kinison. And
yeah,
but we just didn't realize just how insane that got until I read it in your book.
Right.
So things like that, that's very interesting. It's stuff you might already know, but it goes into a lot more detail. And it's really great to get that first perspective, if you were.
Thank you.
So one of the characters in your story, who is normally not mentioned in a lot of detail in the Married with Children world, is Barry Diller.
Yes.
Or Barry Von Diller, as I'll now call him. I love it. Without giving too much away, can you talk about how we might have never even seen the show if it wasn't for his involvement and approval? And is that connected to the Ed O'Neill casting, or is it something else?
Well, you know, Rupert Murdoch is the one who started the whole thing. Barry Diller was legendary. I mean, he was a really well-known, powerful executive that had cut his teeth. You know, he was at ABC. He developed the movie The Week. He developed the Roots miniseries. He was at Paramount, and just a legion of just great shows there. And when he was at Paramount, he wanted to start a fourth network, and it didn't succeed. Well, when Rupert Murdoch brought him over to run Fox, it was understood that Barry Diller would be the architect of this network. And Barry Diller was just a very strong, forceful, visionary executive, very opinionated. And he absolutely had this mandate. And he told everyone under him that the only way to get the viewers away from the entrenched networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, was literally, he said, to pull them by their shirt collar, you know, just to drag them yelling and screaming. So he opened up the development process of the first slate of shows to be on Fox to some of the top producers, Gary Goldberg and Ed Weinberger, and people who had big shows on the air, and gave them freedom because he wanted them to go against the grain. And then one of the only ways, you know, it was a crapshoot for guys like Levitt and Moy and for Ed Weinberger to work for Fox, because these guys were making tons of money working for the traditional networks, and no one knew whether Fox would succeed or not. And these guys could just keep doing their shows at CBS, NBC, and ABC and make millions, and Fox had to give them some incentive. So one of the incentives and one of the reasons that Married was born was Diller's edict that they're allowed to do something different. Okay, so on the one hand, he absolutely opened the door for a show like Married with Children to come along, and Levitt and Moy deciding, you know, we're going to do a show for Fox instead of doing it for NBC because we can have this freedom, and this is the show we want to do. Then when it came to casting, Diller was the head of the pyramid, and he has absolute power over the decisions. And when it came down to casting, everybody was approved. And Ed O'Neill was a favorite of everyone in the casting community, both on the Fox side and on the studio side. But Barry didn't feel that Ed was right for the part.
This is Alpha's version of a pig party, Kel. Instead of ugly, they invite, how should I put this delicately? Morons, cretins, fools, mind-blowing imbeciles. Everyone with a patch is someone's dumb date. Come on, I'll show you.
Hi, I'm Kelly. I'm a model.
I'm Delbert. I'm a Los Angeles public school teacher.
That doesn't prove anything. He could just be a temp or something. Hi, I'm Kelly. I'm a model.
Hi, I'm Ralph. I'm a network executive.
But they prevailed over him. And what he did, though, was he turned the tables on the studio. The studio had been promised that Married with Children was going to be 13 episodes on the air, which is a very strong guarantee, instead of shooting just a pilot and seeing whether it goes on the air or not, which is the traditional network model. They were going to get 13 on the air. Barry Diller, when the studio insisted that they use Ed O'Neill, and Ron and Michael insisted that they use Ed O'Neill for Al Bundy, said, okay, you can have Ed as Al Bundy, but you're not going to be guaranteed 13 on the air. You've got to prove it to me. You've got to shoot that pilot, and then I'll approve it, and we'll see if it goes on the air. And that's what happened. So we went into shooting the pilot, and Ed didn't quite know all of it. He knew that Barry didn't like it, but he didn't know the whole details of the story. So we went into the pilot not knowing whether we were going to have a series or not. And then once he saw the edited version, he approved it. And so that's the long and the short of Barry Diller in the casting process. He was definitely a key in both ways, both in opening up the idea to do a show like Married with Children, and also in potentially not getting it on the air.
It's interesting, and you can read all about this in the book. I find casting quite an interesting thing, and I think the casting on Married with Children is inspired.
Yes.
Yeah, so... Speaking of Michael Moye, as we did earlier, we were very fortunate to interview him a couple of years ago.
Yes, I've heard that.
Oh, great. Yeah.
I heard the interview. I didn't just hear that you did the interview. I heard
it. Oh, I'm glad you listened. Yeah, it was great to talk to him. But so in our interview, he noted that the show was written very much in a Dick Van Dyke-like manner.
Yeah.
With somebody coming in with the storyline and then a team writing an episode as the ensemble team. But he also noted that each person had their own specialty, like whether it was stories or jokes. So we're wondering, in which camp did you fall into?
You know, it's funny because I noted that, and my remembrance of that room, and there was just some great writers in there, Kathy Green, Kevin Curran, Kim Weisskopf, that most of them did overlap with story and jokes. There's often, and it's funny, even there's a little side note. There was a writer who wrote about Married, has written a lot about Married with Children, and he talked about how once Michael and Ron broke up and they ran the show separately, that he felt that Ron was the story guy and Michael was the joke guy. And I was there for so long, I will guarantee you that both Michael and Ron were both story and joke guys. They knew the inside and out. But I think most of the writers that were, I'm going to contradict Michael here. I'll go against that. And I'm a good friend of his. I think most of the writers that he hired were mostly both story and joke. There was one guy, Larry Jacobson, who came from Letterman. And this was his transition in sitcom. And he was more of a joke guy, but he did well on story too. So yeah, I mean, some people are stronger than others on story and joke, but I would say their taste in writers was pretty balanced. So that's a long way of answering a short question, but that's my feeling.
Interesting. The show had a lot of female writers, which, you know, perhaps as a quotient of the audience, they're a bit surprised to learn that.
Right.
Yeah, so you got Catherine Green, Marcy Vosburgh, Stacey Lipp, Ellen L. Fogel, Sandy Sprung. Do you think fans and haters of the show would be surprised that they didn't know this already?
They might be, and you might also be surprised. The first couple of seasons were directed by a woman almost exclusively, Linda Day.
Yeah.
Some of it is I think that the women had a strong voice in the room, and I do think fans would be surprised to know that. And in fact, one of the shows that had the biggest controversy, the period show, which ends up being aired as the camping show, where they go camping and the three women end up having the period at the same time, and they get locked in the cabin and animals come and surround them and so on. That was written by two women, Vosburgh and Sprung. Yes, I think people will be surprised. And some of it is self-selected. It's people who would want to work on that show. You know, that is probably part of it. But no, it was a very strong women's voices in the room, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, well, I certainly appreciate that. I think Marcy Vosburgh, she's the one who wrote Her Cups Runneth Over. And that was the episode that Terry Ricolta saw.
Well, the episode that Terry Ricolta saw, yeah, she was the one, more to the point, if I can skip forward, when Terry Ricolta called to start the boycott of the what ultimately was the boycott of the show, she called to complain about that episode. And Fox didn't have, at the time, like a diplomatic, they didn't have their own Fox PR people to talk to her. They routed her to Marcy at our show. So instead of complaining to a corporate body, she complained to the writer of the show. And that, if anything, that kind of escalated the problem between the show and the boycotter.
Can you tell us more about all of your colleagues on the show, all the writers? I mean, how many writers would typically work on a script at the same time? So what's a typical week in the life of a writer on the show look like?
Okay, well, different shows are run in different ways. Ron and Michael were just collective from the very beginning. There was Ron and Michael, and then there was about 6 or 8 writers. I've been on shows that had 10 or 12 writers. We all come into a room, and we all start pitching out ideas. You know, Ron and Michael probably had the biggest, you know, they probably brought in more ideas than anyone else. But you start pitching out ideas. And then when something sticks, somebody says, oh, that'd be funny. Then you start seeing, is this really a story or is this just a notion? Is there a beginning, a middle, and an end to it? Does it make our characters, does it stretch our characters? Does it fit our characters? And then you start fleshing it out. Everyone is doing this together on Married with Children. Everyone is just sitting in a room. I can't tell you how much fun it is. I mean, it's hard work and you're on a tremendous deadline, but you're just sitting in a room and you're just bullshitting, but you're bullshitting with a purpose. You know, you have this show that you have to do and you have a deadline and you have a timeline and you have these funny characters and you're just sitting there fueling ideas. And then you have these two brilliant writers, Levitt and Moy, who are sort of taking these ideas and forming stories out of them. And you do this all together as a group. And then once a story becomes feasible, it looks like it's a story, then it'll be assigned to a writer. It might be the writer who brought the story in, or it might just be the next writer in line to get a script. And then that writer will go off and develop it further based on the notes that were in the room. Then that writer will bring that document, let's say 2 or 3 pages in outline, back to the room, and everyone will look at it. And when I say everyone will look at it and have a point of view, but Levitt and Moy will, you know, they were like the deciding point of view, and they would look at it, and we would, again, work together to develop it, to see whether the beginning, middle, and end work, the act breaks work, the guest casting works, and so on and so forth. And then you would really beat it out line for line. Not exactly line for line, but whoever's the writer would sit there and take notes. Later on, with more computer-driven shows, you'd have a writer's assistant who would just sit there on a computer and take down all the notes. But at the beginning of the show, in the late 80s anyway, it was pretty much done by hand. And you would sit there, and you'd sit there, honestly, for hours. Ron and Michael would lead the story session. And I had worked with a lot of people, brilliant writers. I have never seen anyone, maybe with the exception of Gary Marshall, who could sit there in a story session like this, where you're breaking a story out and pitch the dialogue, and Al does this and Katie does that and kids do this and so on. And the dialogue is just fully formed in their heads. It was like Al and Peggy were living inside, honestly, inside of Michael and Ron. And I don't mean to diminish what they did. It's very hard. But what they seemed to do is just channel it. You know, it would just spit out at them. And you would just sit there and take the notes. And then you would leave the group and you'd get like a week to go off and write the draft of the script, while the rest of the group went ahead with the next script and the script after and so on and so forth. Then when you come back with that draft, it starts all over again. Everybody, you know, it's in script form, been written up, and the dialogue and stage directions and acts and so on and so forth. And then everyone makes you get it the night before, you make your notes and you change a joke and you add stuff. And then it's the group process again. You start from fade in, and Ron and Michael are leading the group, and you just go all the way through until you get a finished product. When I say finished product, it's a misnomer, because there's essentially never a finished product. Because so the script gets written, you get the notes from the network, then you go to you come in a couple months before production starts, so you can get as many of these scripts written as you can, because once production starts, you have a show to produce. So your production week starts like this. On Monday, actors come in, they sit around a table in the rehearsal hall, and they'll read that script, the script I was just talking about. And this is the first time we hear it out loud. So there's a difference between the page and the stage, we call it. So we're hearing the jokes for the first time with the actors up against each other instead of just in our heads. So after that reading, we get the notes from the network. In this case, they couldn't give too many notes because they weren't allowed to, because of the deal that Michael and Ron made. And then we'll just go up and we will rewrite the script off of what we heard. So we'll make changes based on more of a bit of reality than we had before. It was all in our head before. Now it's real. Meanwhile, the actors are rehearsing what's there. And then that night they get a new copy of the script, and then they come back down and they rehearse all day. And around 3 or 4 o'clock, we're working on other stuff. We get called to the stage, and we'll go to the stage, and they'll do a run through in the sets or in a rehearsal hall in mock sets, one or the other. And after each scene with the director, we sit with the actors. And if something didn't work, maybe Ron or Michael will have an idea of how to make it work, like right on the spot. And then they'll try it, or they will say to us, because Ron and Michael were very big on not just being dictators. If the actors found something that they, or the director, or even the property master found something that they thought would work, they were free to give feedback to Ron and Michael. So it was like this little give and take acting session, you know, like an actor's workshop, where you would go through every single scene like this, where you'd run the scene, we'd sit and talk, run the next scene, sit and talk. And then they go home, we go back, and it starts all over again. We rewrite the script based on what we just saw and what worked and what didn't work. And the director might say, this didn't work here because the prop wasn't right, or this. So all of that, you have to, you know, that's where you're not just a writer, you're a writer slash producer. When people say you're a writer producer, it's not just the word, it's the stage, it's the action. So then we go back and we rewrite that. And that process continues pretty much until Friday, when we shoot it. It's been refined as much as it's going to be refined as we can. And then we start shooting it on the stage. And even then, when we shoot it in front of a live audience, you know, the sitcom form, which is not very popular anymore, live audience sitcom, after every scene, we writers are sitting around looking at the cameras and looking at the actors and listening to the audience, a live audience respond. And if they're not responding to a particular joke, we'll go in with an alternative and we'll change it like right in the moment, and we'll change it up to the last minute. So the script is never, it's an alive process. It keeps going and going and going until you say the end and the bell rings and you let everybody go home. So that's basically what the work is. If you're working on Married with Children, you're doing all of that. You're doing from pitching a germ of an idea in a scene, to finding something that might work on the stage, to suggesting some different kind of blocking, It's a very holistic approach. I want people to understand, as a writer in this business, it's not just words. It's words and picture and people managing too.
I love it. It's like finding out how a secret sauce is made.
I will tell you, the process can get bogged down. You can get executive producers, showrunners like Levitt and Moy, who think that only they're the only one who can create a joke, or only, you know, they can be very dictatorial. And there's just this pecking order, and you're sitting there and you're waiting to raise your hand and so on and so forth. Ron and Michael were so open. And so if all they cared about is making the show funnier, they didn't care that it was the last person hired who made it funnier. And it just, as a writer, it was just so much fun to be in that environment. And I give them just all the credit in the world. And I do think it's reflected in the quality of the show. So I didn't mean to make it a side trip, but I felt that way.
No, that's okay. So is there any insight into how an episode title was assigned to each episode? Is that a writer thing? Is that a producer thing?
I think it just sort of came out of the room. You know, a lot of it is based on popular culture, making fun of other titles or whatever came up. I know, like on, is it Friends, where they do the one where, you know, we didn't have anything like that. I don't think there was a recipe for that on our show. It's just sort of whatever popped up. Certainly no one was like absolutely in charge of that. Once again, it was very democratic. If an idea came up and people liked it, then they used it.
Okay. Yeah, I mentioned that because we're just going to run through your episode titles. If you've got an anecdote or two about each episode, if there's nothing, just say next. But yeah, we'll start from the first episode that you have writing credit for, which is season one's Have You Driven a Ford Lately?
Well, maybe we've been too hard on the guys. Cars are in their blood. You see, with men, they hear the engine and they think it's their engine. They see the sleek and smooth lines of the car and they think they're sleek and smooth. And then they reach for that stick shift and, well, you know what I mean.
The only anecdote I have on that is that there was a friend of ours who's a writer who wasn't on staff, although he wrote an episode. His name is Al Adickman, who had a classic Mustang and was somewhat obsessed about the... you know, well, we obsessed about the ashtray, about, you know, about having it tricked out in classic style. And it really wasn't inspired by any incident in my life at all. it was a vehicle to get, so to speak, to get Al and Steve sort of on the same page. I mean, that's what that was about.
Yeah. I say that was the first one you have a writing credit for. That was the first one to air. But the next episode, 16 Years and What Do You Get, was actually produced before that, before Have You Driven a Ford Lately.
What's that? It's an anniversary present for my wife.
You're going to get that?
Yeah.
How many years you've been married?
One.
Well, see, that explains it. See, you're obviously new to the married game. Let me help you out. See, the first thing I learned on my 16-year tour of duty was that women live for presents. Now, you take the most ornery woman in the world. We'll call her Peggy. Now, you bring a crappy present home, like that picture frame, and your life will be a living hell.
Well, my wife and I agreed that we wouldn't spend too much on our anniversary. We decided we save our money for more important things.
There is no more important thing than your anniversary. See, an anniversary is something special. It's not like other holidays when other people are celebrating too. It's just between the two of you. See, it's a day when you can show how you feel the rest of the year, but you don't, because you're a man.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, to know me is to love me.
That's the anniversary show.
Yes.
And that came out of the room. I mean, I am married. I do have children. I do have anniversaries, but I never set up a premise like that where each of us says we're not going to give anything to the other. And then everybody goes out and breaks that rule. So I can relate to what would happen in that instance, but it didn't come from any real story.
And then the last episode of season one is Johnny Be Gone, which is an episode in real time.
Never wanted to get married, I'm married. Never wanted to have kids, I get two of them. How the hell did this happen?
Yeah, we wanted to do a real-time episode. For viewers who don't know what that is, there's no dissolves. There's no it starts and finishes in 22 and a half minutes or whatever it is. We wanted the challenge of that. And we wanted to just have a strong goal for Al to get out of the house and do something fun and non-family driven. And we wanted the family to just screw him on it. And it didn't come from anything in my life. But I will tell you, at the very end, he says a line that is so classic. Didn't want to get married, got married, didn't want to have kids, got two. How the hell did this happen? And it's sort of, to me, I use it in the book as, that's sort of the story of Married with Children. It's sort of like, how the hell did this happen?
So then we go on to season two, and we've got For Whom the Bell Tolls.
I hate those new crime lights. They make everything look yellow. This neighborhood's ugly enough during the day without having to look at it at night.
I can't comment on that right now, Mom. Al just alked way in the ore day.
Pig Latin Peg, must be your mother. Tell her I said oink. What are all these envelopes on the table, Peg? Is this supper? It's a bill for that crime light. A $50 assessment. Peg, they're charging me $50. Gee, I wish I had someone to pay my bill so I could go.
I've had experiences where you fight City Hall or you fight a phone bill, you know, which Al did. My own experience with this was a trigger point for the story. Where Mary took it was that Al becomes so stubborn in getting a phone bill mischarge rectified that he basically destroys his whole family. That didn't happen with me, but it's a very relatable thing that has happened to me. The whole idea of trying to fight City Hall, which literally he did too over the street lamp that was involved in that show. So that does come from a bit of a personal experience.
And the next episode, also in season two, an episode that's going to be of interest to a lot of people, You Better Watch Out. So this is the first Married with Children's first Christmas episode.
Santa's gone. I'll never be able to enjoy Christmas again.
Well, you're in the right place.
Come on, Marcy, these things happen.
When has this happened?
Come on, Marcy, cheer up. It could have been worse. He could have landed on the picket fence.
The impetus was from that. I mean, I had actually heard your interview with Moy, and he said one of the writers had talked about experiencing Santa falling into a mall and dying. It certainly did not happen to me, and I don't remember that as being anyone bringing in it as the genesis of the show. The genesis of that show was to fulfill the idea of doing a so totally different Christmas show than any other network would do, that it was just in your face. We're going to kill Santa in our backyard. And the two things that, if I may digress, the things that happened anecdotally within that show, and both Ed and David Garrison relate this to me, and it's in the book. Spoiler alert, when Stanner falls to his death in the Bundy backyard through the window, and the family's watching TV at the time, they're watching a televised version of it. And then they turn to see, my God, Santa's died. And both Ed O'Neill and David Garrison could not stop laughing. And of course, it's the most inappropriate time to laugh because you're witnessing a death. And so we had to do several things. We had to keep doing takes so we could get them without laughing. And in fact, I think it was David who told me there's a term for it, and it's appropriate in this game. When an actor inappropriately laughs, it's called corpsing, because when you play a corpse, that's the most inappropriate time to laugh. So that happened during the filming of that week. That interrupted our process, but we got past it. It's not like Saturday Night Live, where when they laugh, they like to keep it in. We have to cut it out. That's that story.
Well, it's an iconic episode for so many reasons.
Yes, thank you.
And that's the last episode where you share a writing credit with Catherine Green.
We wrote a lot of episodes together. I want to include her in this. We wrote a lot of stuff together. We weren't partners per se, but we worked on the show at the same time, almost at the same level. So we ended up writing a lot of stuff together.
Right. So the next episode in season three is The Gypsy Cried, and you've got a solo writing credit on that one.
I hope I'm not intruding.
She is incredible. Did you sense our presence here?
No, I sensed you were leaving the party without paying me.
Oh, no, Madam Olga, of course not. But as long as you're here, I haven't had a chance to get my fortune read.
Steve, please, I really think we should do this back at our house.
No, please, sit down. I feel very strong vibrations here.
Did you leave your toy running under the couch again?
No, it's in the shop. It's being turbocharged.
The Gypsy Cried, it's about Al having a streak of good luck and ending up riding in first class because Al becomes Marcy's good luck charm, and she's afraid of traveling without him. He ends up, I mean, it's the conceit of the show. He ends up in first class. I will tell you an anecdote about that. When we were rehearsing this scene, Al's sitting in first class with Peggy, as are Steve and Marcy. And they're just sitting there in first class, and they're so out of place. They're just, what's the expression, pigs and shit. I mean, they're just, you know, they brought in the snacks from the first class lounge with them and so on and so forth. And I looked at the set, and we had established at that point how bad Al's foot odor is. And I said, right there in rehearsal, I said, wouldn't it be funny if he takes off his shoes and the oxygen masks all come down at the same time?
That's it? No, have a pleasant flight? No, we won't crash. No, Marcy Rhodes is not going to die.
Hey, Mars, you're a little loud over there. Now, listen, you're flying first class. Let's act like you've done this a couple of times before. Hey, waitress.
Sir, we have some complimentary in-flight slippers. If you'd care to take off your shoes and relax.
This is an example of what I was talking about earlier, of sort of the living process of the show. And the prop people got right on it. And the next day they rigged it up and he takes off his shoes. The stewardess offer him a slipper. The masks come down, and it was just a huge laugh, and it became a classic moment. And it's an example that this whole thing is a living, you keep messing with it. You keep tooling with it. You can tool with it too much too. But that was an anecdote of something that happened like on the spot during that week.
Okay, cool.
That.
Pigs and Shit, that might be a good alternative title for a book. So we jump forward a few episodes later that season. You do a three job, no income family.
Beam me up a burger, Bundy. Warp speed.
People out there dying for kangaroo, huh?
That's right. Tell the world, Bundy.
Yeah, that was just, wouldn't it be fun if Peggy worked? You know, my wife worked, and it wasn't an issue. It didn't come out of my life, if that's what you're asking.
No, okay. After that, though, we jumped forward a few seasons.
Yeah, I went off to work at another studio for a couple of years and then came back. I was off the show for a couple of years.
Right. I thought perhaps you were that upset that David Garrison had left.
Oh, no.
But no, you came back for season seven. So the episode is Every Bundy Has a Birthday.
Anyway, the kid here wants a crack at your piñata.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Hold on.
And I want one of them burgers. Yeah, I reclaim this park for the people. And I reclaim this hot dog for the people, and this steak for the people.
That's mine. That's it. Eat hot, Gucci pal.
And I suppose this would stick out for some because season 7 has become quite a bit infamous because of the character 7.
Right. Okay. So independent of the negative aspect of using 7, the anecdote, the thing that from my real life that we used in that episode is we used to take our kids to the park sometimes for birthday celebrations. And one time at the park, there was an area cordoned off that someone privately had paid for that we couldn't use that day at the park. So in the Everybody Has a Birthday, Al takes 7 to the park for a birthday. He gets, cajoled into doing that. And they go and they can't use a certain area of the park because a rich family has screened it off. So this becomes the vehicle for Al to fight the rich family. And as it happens, my kids were the extras. They were the kids of the rich family in that episode.
Oh, cool.
It was all about really getting Al riled up at this rich guy who thought he could have the park for a private party when he wanted to, have a party for 7. But so that was the genesis of that part of the story anyway.
Oh, that's so cool that your kids are in it. So the last episode that the 7 character appeared in is your next episode you've got a writing credit for is Peggy and the Pirates. Very popular episode.
Captain, men would like a shot at Big Red.
Please, no.
Not now, Wilbur. Methinks that Scarlet will bring a bigger ransom as a virgin. But these wenches are fair game. But as usual, the first choice goes to my first mate, Fluvio the Handsome. Ho, Fluvio!
Hello, me pretties. It's time to partake of a hot flagon of Fluvio. You there. How would you like to play a game of hide the hooters with Fluvio? Come, wenches. Kiss me or kiss the sharks.
How many times do I have to tell you? Don't give them a choice.
Peggy and the Pirates is just a straight out fantasy. I'm sure Ron or Michael just thought, actually, Michael wasn't there that year. So everyone thought that it would be funny to just do this escapist fantasy and costume. And it was a great vehicle for Garrison to come back because he has this Broadway swords dancing and all that those kinds of skills. So we just had a ball doing that one. And also by then we knew that 7 really wasn't scoring. So 7 was just the vehicle and Peggy was reading him a swashbuckling pirate story. Then we dissolve in the story and then we came back. So it was just an easy way to use 7 without really using him. So that was a great fun episode.
I think that comes through just how much fun they're all having. So the next episode is season 8's Luck of the Bundys. Al and Luck again.
Do you realize what this means?
Yes, Peg, I do. After Bud's arrested, that'll mean all 4 of us will have a record for indecent exposure.
Honey, why is it so hard for you to admit that you're having good luck?
Peg, have you ever heard of the Bundy curse?
You mean that foot odor thing?
The other curse. You see, the minute that a Bundy starts having good luck, he immediately starts to build up an equal amount of bad luck. It's simple Bundynomics.
Does not come from my experience. Generated from the room, like most of these are. I mean, they mostly are sort of generated from the room. I mean, someone in the room may have had something like that happened. But anyway, that was a room-generated story.
There is an iconic line in there where Al just says offhandedly, it's simple Bundynomics. And I like that word, Bundynomics.
I'm sure that was read from the headlines, yeah.
Yeah.
Bushanami, never, yeah.
The next episode, a few episodes later in season 8, is Dances with Wheezy, where Al and Jefferson go to a sports bar.
I couldn't help overhearing you two. And after sucking down 20 cold ones and a couple of warm ones, my memory and my bladder have been jogged. It was Bubba Smith. Thank you! And that's the law talking.
It was Billy Martin, I know, because I have it on tape.
It was Bubba Smith, I know, because I don't know anything except that.
Billy Martin!
Bubba Smith!
Billy Martin!
Bubba Smith!
Billy Martin!
Bubba Smith!
I think this came out of the personal experience of wanting to do something with the guys when the wives had something that they wanted to do that we didn't want to. I mean, Al and Jefferson were roped into seeing a stage version of the Jeffersons, which was also a callback. I mean, because Michael and Ron were on the Jeffersons, so they could make ass fun of that. That literally didn't happen to me, but it really came from how can we have a boys' night out?
Right.
That's an example of the most broad part of Married with Children, because they put like stick figures where they were to fool the wives that they were still there, put up puppets and like that. But, you know, it paid off, so it worked.
Yeah. And then we jump to season 9, and we've got Business Sucks, but just part 1.
If you just bring your cameras this way, you will see the master at work. Now, Marcy... Before I unleash my ultimate weapon, I'm going to be gracious and give you and your milk duds there a chance to hoof it on out of here. What do you say?
No way, old smeller. We have drawn our line in the sand, and we shall not be moved.
Yeah!
Fine. If you want and all that war, you've got one. No, ma'am. Heavyweight Division Company, halt! Present Beer Bellies. Boogie down.
Yeah, we divided that up. No, that's where the, I believe that's where Marcy and the breastfeeders.
Yes.
Yeah. No, that didn't come from me. I mean, it came out of me, but it didn't. The genesis wasn't me.
Okay. The last episode of season 9 to be produced anyway, you can talk about this one a little bit with enemies in a sec, but this is the second of 3 spin-off attempts for Married with Children, and it's called Radio Free Tremaine.
This is Oliver Cole.
And Mark Campbell.
Here on the voice of Tremaine College, WHIP Radio.
And for those of you on the football team, that spells whip.
And this is the Mark and Oliver Show, where our motto is, together, we're still not as fat as Rush Limbaugh.
I was, one of the senior writers, and so they turned to me as someone who might do a spinoff. You know, it's valuable to the show. It's valuable to the studio. So I was one of the senior writers. I believe I wrote it with Stacey Lipp. And I came out of, and I mentioned this earlier, I was a journalism student in college, and the idea of a college radio station seemed to me a rich area to do a spinoff because Bud was in college. So that's where that came from. You know, you get these opportunities contractually from the network to do a spinoff, and you follow them through. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Neither of ours did. But it came out of my experience with journalism in college, thinking that that would be a good area.
Yes, you did write that with Stacey Lipp, and you were both credited for the next episode, which was right at the beginning of season 10, and this is A Shoe Room with a View.
Gentlemen, I'd like to propose a toast.
Hear, hear!
In the course of human history, there have been 4 great inventions. The bikini.
Yes!
The thong bikini. The really itchy thong bikini. And Al
Al's idea to put an aerobic studio next to the shoe store.
If I have seen far, it's because I have stood on the shoulders of giants. Einstein, Magellan, Heineken.
A shoe room with a view. I'm striking out here on incidents that triggered episodes that I wrote. It has nothing experience.
No, well, yeah, that's okay. Well, how about Blonde and Blonder?
Can you believe that tomorrow is our 5-year high school reunion? I mean, that means we've been out of school for years. I hear people are coming from all over for this reunion.
Mm-hmm. Even foreign countries like Indiana.
Indonesians are coming? We better brush up on our Spanish.
No, Stacey and I think that is Stacey Lip, right? Who's very blonde.
Yes.
No, we just, that just came out of the room.
The next episode, already mentioned, but this is the third of three spin-off attempts, and this is called Enemies. That's credited to you, Stacey Lip and Russell Marcus.
Well, let me know if there's anything I can do to just hurry it along.
Oh, Henry!
You can moan like Shannon.
Oh, Henry!
Oh, Henry?
Henry? I mean, oh, Tom!
Oh, Kelly, lower!
Take me to the bathroom.
Okay, so again, we have an opportunity to do a spinoff. So you have an opportunity as a writer to have your own show. And the idea being that it was sort of working backwards for me from the Married with Children idea. Married with Children took all these family comedies were out there and they all had a similar kind of sensibility, and Married with Children was going to be the anti-family comedy, the anti-Cosby comedy. And so at the time there were a lot of Friends-like shows. And so I thought we could sort of go along those lines and do an anti-Friends show called Enemies. That's where the idea came from, and everyone signed off on it. Everyone thought that was a good idea, and we cast it and we shot it, and it didn't really work. You know, you take a spinoff like Frasier, and you know that character from Cheers, and you don't have to do a lot of mechanics and heavy furniture moving to put him into a new situation. To do a spinoff, what's called a planted spinoff, which is what both of these were, Radio Free Tremaine and Enemies, on an existing series, is very difficult because you have to deliver to the audience the Ed and the Katie and the Bundy family that they expect. And then you have to introduce new characters, and then you have to create empathy for those characters, and you have to create a desire for them, for people to come back to them. We didn't do a good enough job. And plus, it's a formidable task to do it within the context of an ongoing series.
So do you think that's why these spinoffs didn't take? I mean, like Al himself, a lot of fans don't like change.
Yeah, I think that the characters just weren't really, I mean, I'll take credit where credit's due and blame where blame is due. They just didn't sit that well with the audience. And some of it may have had to do with whatever the network's needs were. They were doing, you go into their system, you create this pilot spinoff and it goes in their system and they see whether they want to do it or not. And so, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into it, but I won't sit here and say, oh, that was the greatest thing since ice cream and they didn't see it my way. I don't feel that way.
Yeah. Oh, no, I appreciate that. And so the last episode on this list is the first episode to air of season 11, the final season, and it's Twisted.
Well, since we're stuck here, we might as well play Mad Libs, okay? I need a verb.
Clock.
Okay.
Somebody give me a command.
Cluck you.
I like you.
You know, perhaps Mad Libs is just a little too advanced for you people, so let's just play 20 questions, okay? Who'll ask the first question?
Go to hell.
That's not a question.
Why don't you go to hell?
I really like you.
I'm good at games, except I always lose at strip poker.
By then, I had left the show. I was a consultant. I wasn't running the show anymore. And I think that was snatched right out of the headline. No, I think that was actually a major, I think that was a major motion picture at the time about a twister.
Yeah.
And we thought, you know, wouldn't it be fun if the Bundys were caught in a twister? And the one thing that I remember distinctly from that I think was quite unique and terrific was that you discover, and this is preposterous, it goes along the category of broadness and cartoonishness, you discover at the end, off in a barn or like a basement, so, you know, avoiding the twister, and you discover that the guys have tunneled previously from their basement into the nudie bar. They come up in the nudie bar. Anyway, that's... That was one that was a lot of shows do this, and we didn't do it too much. Taken from popular movie time.
So, are there any other episodes that we haven't mentioned, but perhaps you've provided a gag or a joke that has been well received, but you don't necessarily have a credit for?
Well, the gag that I had the credit for, the gag of the air mask coming down, even though that was my credit, but that wasn't in the original draft. That happened spontaneously as we were watching it. No, the one thing that I sort of inspired, my father-in-law, rest his soul, he was a runner well into his senior years, in his 80s, even in his 90s, and he liked to do senior Olympics, and he was just in great shape, and it was just a great fantasy of his. And we did this show, Go for the Old. It was a show where Ed lied. Ed wanted to recapture his athletic prowess, you know, that he had in his football years and triumph in sports. So he lied about his age and dyed his hair gray so he could get in the senior Olympics.
Yes.
So he could win a trophy. And my father-in-law was in that episode as a runner that actually passed him in the Olympics.
Well, it looks like it's going to be a duel between you and me. It's going to be rough. I'm a long distance man, but I'm going to win this event and take that gold. It means a lot to me. So much I actually considered competing before I was 65, just to get an itch. Pathetic, huh? Well, what kind of an example would that be for the grandkids? So I trained for a whole year, and I'm going to win it fair and square.
I take some credit for that episode.
Oh, cool. I did not know that. And yes, that's Go for the Old in season 7.
Yeah.
So Michael Moyer has correctly noted that people like you were truly the unsung heroes of the show. And so this is quite a bit of a loaded question, but do you feel that writers get enough credit for their work?
You know, it's interesting. We may be unsung here. You know, obviously the Ed O'Neill and Katie Sagal and Christina and David, and they're the face of the show. So when people think of the show, they think of them. We put the words in their mouth. So I guess you could say we're the unsung heroes. I can just see a bunch of people thinking, well, boo-hoo. I mean, I don't think it needs to be rectified all that much, because being a writer, you know, as I hope you've gathered from my enthusiasm, has a lot of very strong intrinsic benefits. The pay is generally good. Satisfaction in working on a show where you can sit around and share ideas and make jokes, see your work produced, is very high. So it's hard for me. I know writers do complain that they're sort of the unsung heroes. I feel that I've been very fulfilled as a writer and recognized in a lot of different, my credits are up there and people know who I am. So I step back from that characterization. I can't say that it's a big problem for me, to be frank.
Okay, good. No, that's fine. It's just interesting to discuss things like writing in light of recent strikes where people, it's more actors' strikes, but the fear that AI may take over the world.
I'm going to add an addendum to that. When I was a writer in my heyday and Married with Children and some shows after and some of the shows before, writers were really in demand. And we had 10 or 12 writers on a show. And, you know, with the strike, there, you know, people were saying they had 4, 5, or 6. And then they had writers or 3 and that the writers couldn't go to the stage. And we spent all of our time on the stage. So the halcyon days of me being a writer was different. So I can't speak about unsung heroes vis-a-vis what's going on right now. And it may be more appropriate right now that they're sort of considered unsung heroes. I was really speaking from my own experience. So I'll add that addendum. You're right.
Yes. Well, that's completely fair. You've mentioned this person already, but one of the people you interview in your book is Terry Rakolta. So was it almost surreal to talk to somebody after all these years who, I mean, you talk about her, but, you know, especially since your first exposure to her was so adversarial?
It was very surreal. It was a little difficult to track her down. She's actually quite a woman of the world. She married like an ambassador or something like that. She travels around. She's actually a patron for the arts. When I did talk to her, it was very cordial. You know, she was this one-man band who almost got the show taken off the air. She didn't have any regrets. And I discovered a story, which is in the book and maybe sourced other places, where there was sort of this, one of the reasons that it got so out of hand, and you brought it up earlier, that she talked to Marcy Bosberg. She saw the show. She called Fox, corporate Fox, to complain about it, which is where you would call. And because I mentioned this, that they didn't have like a corporate affairs or a public, they were new or naive or whatever. Her call got shuffled over to our show where she talked to the writer of the show. Now, the writer of the show is not going to apologize for a show that she wrote. And though I know Marcy is very cordial, and I know that part of the content of what she said was, you know, she said, you know, my mother doesn't even like the show. But we take the point of view that if you don't like the show, you should turn it off. You know, instead of us changing it, you have choices, basically.
Is there anything else, gentlemen?
Yeah. Look, I know we could have been a little more articulate if we had taken notes like I wanted to do instead of staying up all night watching the Panty Clause. Point here is we know where real violence comes from, and it's not from that magic box I like to call TV. Oh, sure, the tube can be blamed for a lot of things. Brent Musburger, Full House, any show where overweight female cops dress up as hookers. But violence, that's too easy. We've all been brought up on Roadrunner cartoons and the Three Stooges. But how many of us have run a saw across a bald guy's head? Yeah. How many of us have drawn a tunnel on the side of a mountain only to watch our loved ones smash themselves into it? Yeah. And you know why? Because we had parents, ladies and gentlemen. Parents who said, don't do what TV tells you to do. Do what we tell you to do, or it's 5 across the eyes. Anyway, I say if there's a problem with TV today, it's because parents aren't saying that anymore. Take my kids. Please. Thanks for the joke, Jefferson.
Kennedy's on the floor.
Kennedy's always on the floor. Anyway, my kids may not be angels, but when they screw up, I don't blame TV. I put the blame squarely where it belongs. On their mother. Yeah!
And this set Terry off. I mean, Terry explained this to me, that she feels that if she had called in and somebody had been like sort of more sympathetic to what she was talking about and taken it to a committee and tried to redress the grievances with the show and through, like you say, Jamie Kellner, one of the executives and so on and so forth. She may have been mollified or at least not so agitated. And she, you know, she was very frank, and she said it really sent her on a one-man mission, one-woman mission, one-person mission to put an end to the show. And she started calling the advertisers.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Senator Furman, and I am chairman of the Presidential Subcommittee for Taste in Television.
Hey, Al, Taste in Television. T-I.
Shut up.
So the history of it could have been changed if she had gone through different channels. She was very nice. I was nice to her. You know, it's an irony, and she understands it, that because she almost got the show canceled, she was a big part of the history of making the show popular because all the publicity drove a lot of people to watch the show. Now, that said, we still had to win those viewers over. They came to watch the show and they stayed watching it. So it's still a test. It's not just because she drove them to the show. But yes, it was very surreal. And she spent a lot of time with me and I was very appreciative of it. And she understood that I was going to write it in a book, and she didn't censor herself or censor me. And she also talked about how she was harassed, how she became the subject of a media backlash, and people, they called her the Ayatollah Ricola. And when the newspapers published her divorce proceedings, just, you know, kind of went, I mean, I'm not feeling sorry for her, but she was actually kind of victimized. The whole thing just really kind of blew out of proportion. It's kind of a big deal. But to answer your first question, yes, it was surreal to be face to face or telephone to telephone with the person that almost changed the destiny of the show.
Yeah, I mean, she could have ended the show almost single-handedly. But if history had gone a different way, we might not have gotten 11 seasons.
Yes, oh, exactly.
It's extraordinary to think about, especially in hindsight. So was there anything in the book that you've left out that you wish perhaps made the cut?
It was a personal anecdote, and it had to... And I talk in a few places about how unusual, and I've talked here about how unusual Ron and Michael are, where they, you know, they really tried to make a family of the cast and crew, and they weren't elitist at all. And they would help people get raises, and they would help people with their... I remember Ron, this is a story I could have told that I didn't tell. What we've largely described in the podcast are writers who are on staff, who get paid to write on a show, and you're there on an ongoing basis. And you also get scripts in addition to that, you know, when you make money separately from those scripts. X number of scripts every year are by freelance writers who come in and pitch you ideas, and they're not on staffs. Maybe they're aspiring writers, or maybe they've chosen not to be on staff. I remember one time, Ron, there was somebody who couldn't make his house payments that he knew, who was a freelance writer, and he said, "We're giving you a script. And so you come in and we'll give you a script." And the irony is that he didn't like the idea. We were giving him this free script. It was $12,000 or $15,000 or whatever, plus residuals, and he fought us tooth and nail on the idea that we gave him. He wanted to do his own idea. That was kind of a funny story. The other story was a human interest story, where, and it's rather extraordinary. There was a guy in Hollywood who was famous for this, and what he did was he imitated people's voices. And he imitated, this is just to show Ron's, and Michael's like this too, but this happened with Ron Levitt's soul. Ron gets a call in the middle of the night from who he thinks is David Faustino. You know the end of the story, it's an imitator, who says, "I'm in trouble, there was a drug bust, you've got to come and get me." So Ron gets up out of bed, takes a friend with him, goes to a place where David says, "Oh, they've taken me someplace else." Ron, he calls him on the cell phone. Ron goes someplace else. Finally, Ron figures out that it's a phony, goes home, and then next day the whole thing is revealed, and this guy has also done voices of other celebs. But the end of the story is that Ron went to the ends of the earth, put himself in peril for this actor on our show who said, I'm in trouble. Michael did the same thing and went out of his way to get people promotions or get them other jobs and so on and so forth. And so that's one story. I didn't have a place for in the book.
No, that's really nice. Married with Children has left a mark, if you will, on world culture. But what's your reaction to it being dubbed or reshot in different countries? I mean, what was your reaction to writing completely new scripts for the Russian version? I mean, what was that phone call like?
It was after the show had been canceled. And so I was called in with Kathy Green and one other writer. And we wrote like 10 shows for Russia. And it was really odd because you had to keep it within the Married with Children characters. You had to, to back up a little bit, the show was so popular in Russia, they shot all the scripts that they could. And then they went on for more than 11. They had more shows that they wanted to do. So we had to write new scripts. And that's very surreal. It was fun to do. I mean, we sort of fell right back into the old rhythms. But it surprised me that it did so well in Russia. Not only Russia, Brazil, Poland, just kind of all over the world. And I had the occasion in writing the book to talk to a writer who did, I just did a few of these, you know, on a freelance basis, to talk to a writer who did do more of them in different countries. And I said, why do you think it's so popular in so many different other cultures? Because it's so American. But they said it's just the plight of a guy against the system. And whether it's the system in Russia, whether it's the system in Brazil or whatever, that stands out. And that's what translated to all these other countries. Especially since it's not like we had star power. It's not like it was like Friends or something like that, where it was, you know, kind of big star. I mean, they were, Ed, don't get me wrong, and Katie and Christina and David, I mean, they're stars in their own right, but it's not like that was the draw. I mean, the draw really was the content. Not too many years ago, maybe 7 or 8, no, maybe 10 or 12, I was sent over to Tel Aviv to work on the Russian adaptation of the show. Actually, they were doing 2 or 3 of my scripts. Did I say Russian? I mean, Israeli. And while I was over there, one interesting thing is that not every script will adapt exactly to the culture. Like they may not have teller machines in a particular country. In Israel, Al came in Tel Aviv. The story called for Al to come in, as he's prone to do, and announce that he's home and take a bottle of beer out of the refrigerator and just drink. And they say if an Israeli man was doing that, he'd have a drinking problem if he were drinking alone. So they had to modify things like baseball cards. If your mom sold your baseball cards or something like that, couldn't fly in that environment. But in the story I wanted to tell is that when I was in Tel Aviv and I was telling people what I was doing, I was over there doing the Israeli version of Married with Children. I was welcome with open arms. And I was once in a crowded restaurant and I was talking to a bartender because I was over there alone. So I was often eating alone. I was eating at the bar. And when he found out, I told him I worked for Married with Children, he started singing the theme song from Psycho Dad in the middle of this restaurant.
Who's the man who kills for fun? Psycho Dance, Psycho Dance, Dance with a gun. But he loves his son. Killed his wife as he weighed a ton. Psycho Dance!
And I'm just thinking, I'm halfway around the world. And here's a guy singing a song that appeared maybe in 3 episodes to me in the middle of a crowded restaurant. And I thought, wow, we really have had an impact. So that was kind of stunning to me.
Indeed. So what is your take on comedy and comedy writing today? Are there any new writers in or shows that we should be looking out for that you consider well-written?
I think The Bear is wonderful, and it does combine. It's way different than Married with Children. It's gritty, it's dark, but it really does combine the comedy and drama, and has a very gritty setting. And I just think there's nothing that's been that way like that in a long time. And I thought The Bear was wonderfully written. I'm sorry I don't have the writer's name. I don't give credit to. And there's another show a few years back that Ricky Gervais was in. I know he's been in a lot of series, but it's called Afterlife.
Oh, yeah.
It's as funny as it is poignant. It's about him coming to terms with his wife's death, and he keeps talking to her in a fantasy sequence. At the same time, his life goes on, and he works. It's a little Al Bundy-ish. I mean, he works in a supermarket rack, like a throwaway newspaper that's way, way below him. And I just think that's a terrific show. Those two are pretty much the ones that stand out. I mean, I still watch Seinfeld. I was still on, Curb Your Enthusiasm, but I don't follow network comedy all that closely anymore.
No, well, they're both great shows. I haven't seen The Bear yet.
The Bear is wonderful. It calms down. In the first season, it's funny because my wife and I watch it together, and there's a lot of screaming and yelling, and it's just because it's the environment. It's just starting a restaurant, and there's a lot of interesting and characters and their relationships, and it calms down a little bit in the second season, but it's very ruckus, and it's very, you know, as a Married with Children fan, I think you'd like it for, and not expecting it to be like Married with Children, but it has a very out loud sensibility.
Yeah, well, my husband is a big fan of it, and he used to be a cook, so he recommends it highly as well. Yeah, so The Bear was created by Christopher Storer.
Okay, all right. Well,
that's just to give him.
Thank you.
There. But yeah, Afterlife is great too.
Yeah.
Right, so speaking of comedy today, we touched on this earlier, but there's been a bit of recent interest in Married with Children again, to the point where over the last 10 years, literally, there's been talk of a potential reboot.
Right.
And lately it was talk of doing it in an animated form. But now that looks like it's kind of dead on the vine. That's just what bits that we can glean from the internet and bits that, you know, actors have said at comic cons or things like that. But were you approached to write or produce or be involved in any part of that?
No, early on, I was one of the people who came, Kathy Green and I had talked to them about being a reboot, but this was like way, way back. And, you know, we just didn't get anywhere with it. And I understand there's legal problems and problems with the family. You know, there's some creative rights problems that they do have an issue. And apparently they've surmounted that with the cartoon idea, but they just haven't been able to sell it. I was talking with the actors too, and I think it's almost dead, like you said. My only feeling is it may be a better choice than a real reboot, just because it's such a live action cartoon anyway, and it's always going to be compared to the original, and it's always going to be difficult to match that. So a cartoon might be a better way to go. But I had nothing to do with it, nor was I approached to do it. But I'd watch it.
Yeah, 'cause animation would be a good way to freeze it in time. But like you say, you know, people don't like change, and so they want the show from the old days. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. It's really tough.
But David Faustino in particular is quite frank on Instagram about, you know, people holding out, or, you know, who's responsible for rights not being approved and things like that. So you can always check out his Instagram for updates.
Yeah, no, David was very good with me with the book too. And yeah, and he's the one that, you know, he really wanted to do, you know, there was an idea floating where it would be married with grandchildren and he would be the patriarch and it would be his kids. And I mean, that's a natural way to do it. And you wouldn't have, and, you know, and then maybe Ed and Katie would just come and babysit or visit once in a while or something like that, that it wouldn't be relentlessly the same show.
So, you know, if an animated series was made today, I mean, how would it affect the way it would be written based on how you've described the original series is made?
I don't know whether they would just take, I'm guessing that they wouldn't go back and redo the episodes. They would just go further. You know, I don't know. I mean, so much of what we did came from a live audience. So as you just made me think about it, that with animation, you don't get that opportunity. And we would feed off of the live audience. And it's funny because, in fact, I just was listening to a podcast of yours that you did with Michael Moy. And I write about this in the book, too. At some point, we almost let the audience take the wheel of the car, that we just went in the directions that we know that the audience would like. It's hard to imagine, as you posed that question, how you would do that in an animated form. I'd love to see some. I mean, there must be a version of it because they sold it off of something. I'd like to see a version of it. Maybe we can leak it to your podcast.
That'd be amazing. I'm hoping, you know, maybe it will wind up on eBay one day, like the original unaired pilot did. I don't know if you remember that. About 20 years ago, the original pilot found its way online.
Yeah.
With the original kids.
Yeah.
I think this stems partly, at least, in response to Married with Children not having a proper finale in its original run. So I think fans are feeling a little burnt. Plus, we love the show so much. We want to see them all in the same room together and things like that. So it's nostalgic.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But one of the ways that we do keep Married with Children alive is by writing books or perhaps creating a humble little podcast. And I know you've listened to our podcast created by Alex and headed up by the original team, Alex and Jerry, who's a big Steve fan. And then we came in later and took care of it. But how do you think we did telling the story of the show, as it were, from our perspective as fans?
I love your podcast. In a way, it's kind of the audio version of what, I mean, I'm trying to just keep the legacy of the show alive. And I think you've done it in a, you know, very unique way. Your enthusiasm is infectious. I mean, you know, just going to the show for the tapings, you know, the audience would go crazy. And you captured, you know, with your own people in the background and egging each other on. And I really think that you honored the fan base. You have a raucousness about you at your best. And I think that you guys speak your minds as individuals, like the characters in the book. So I just think you did a great job. It's why when you guys go off on tangents, I mean, it's not really tangents, but when you go off and come back, I don't know, there was, it definitely mimicked, it mimicked the show. It wasn't academic. And nor was it just toilet talk, you know, it was like it found a balance between, and the show wasn't that way too. So I think you've captured the essence of the show. I mean, people who really dismiss the show can just think, oh, it's just vulgar, vulgar, vulgar. But people like you who understand it and who talked about it understand, you know, I even heard you an episode where you're talking about some of the literary references and things like that. Do understand that it's not just, and it's not even trash for trash sake. And the other thing that I talk about in the book, and this is a little off the subject, but I think it's important to note that and you do this and the show, it doesn't just, yes, it slaps sitcoms in the face, but it honors the sitcom. I mean, it the structure of it is like a sitcom, and you're sitting down like a sitcom family, and you have expectations of certain points in the story that it plays the way a sitcom family does. And when it turns on that, it's because it's played on your expectations of that. It's not totally out of the blue. And I think you capture that also in podcasts. You capture those moments very well. So kudos to you.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Richard. That's really nice to hear. Yeah, Alex started this podcast and I knew immediately I wanted to be involved just behind the scenes. And we ended up, you know, being its unofficial caretakers for the second half. And we've got a great team of people behind it, including Chris, who set up this interview today. And Chris is such a lovely guy.
Yeah.
What goes through your mind when you stop and think that people yet to be born we'll still be enjoying your body of work from decades from now? Because besides Married with Children, you've worked on some iconic shows.
You know, I don't think about it too much. I'm happy that I've seen other generations enjoy it, like my kids and their friends. And I've been on shows. The last few shows I was on, I was with younger writers, And they would tell me, like you did, that they saw it when they were 8 or 9 or something like that, or 10. And some of them would tell me, I'm so happy to be working with you. My parents wouldn't let me watch your show when I was a kid. So I think more of that than future generations. I'm somewhat awestruck at the idea that my name and my words and so on will be out there. It's humbling. And it certainly, I've never had any, I've had regrets about certain shows or certain people I work for and certain episodes and so on and so forth. I've never had any regrets about being in this business and making people laugh. And that's why I was drawn to your podcast, because you keep making people laugh and you honor that.
Yeah.
I don't think too much about the future, but I'm honored and I'm humbled that that people will be laughing at jokes I've made for generations to come.
Is it surreal to you that all these shows have lived so long in syndication?
Yeah, and that there's a huge market. It was just surreal that, I mean, Mary just keeps going. Actually, my son, talking about that, my son works for Pluto, which is a free streaming service. And they have a Married with Children channel. They run Married with Children. So that's it's kind of a generational thing to be proud of.
Yeah, I want to point out that Pluto in Australia does not have Married with Children, unfortunately.
Huh.
But it's okay. I've got the series several times over.
I'll talk to him about
it. I appreciate that.
Where do you see it? Is it on Hulu?
Well, I don't get Hulu in Australia either. But yeah, we've got Amazon Prime, and it used to be on there, but it was taken off recently. It's not even on Disney Plus in Australia, because I know Fox now owns Disney. So, or Disney owns Fox. I forget which way around it is. But yeah, I mean, I've got the show. I've got it all on my computer. I've got every DVD release every time one of the releases was out. So I've got the show several times over. I'm fine. But I feel for people who just live from, it's not even running on TV here at the moment, but I feel for those who don't have the option to stream.
Yeah.
Because it is very convenient.
Well, you've done a great job keeping me alive. I appreciate that.
Well, you've done a great job with this book. And I want to say it's The Married with Children Versus the World, the inside story of the shock-com that launched Fox and changed TV comedy forever. And you should go out and buy it today. But Richard, I want to know, are there any other new projects besides this book that you're currently working on? And where can fans and other people find you online? Do you have a website?
No, I don't have a real online presence. You know, my credits that you looked up on IMDb are pretty much where I am online. And I have a couple of documentary ideas, but they're so in germ form that I can't really even talk about them now. And if we'll see how this book does, I might like to write another book. It's a completely other discipline than writing a TV series. So I don't have anything else to promote except my book. And I thank you so much for plugging it.
No, that's okay. And if you do write a second book or another book on Married with Children, I'm very happy to help you if I can. You know, if you need a second pair of eyes or a fact checker or something like that, you know.
Yeah, I had known I would have contacted you during the writing of it, but I thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for writing this book, which, again, is called Married with Children Versus the World, the inside story of the shock-com that launched Fox and changed TV comedy forever. And everybody listening to this should go out and buy this today. You can get it online. If you haven't pre-ordered it already, you can buy it online where all good books are purchased from. It's a fantastic history of a show that we all know and love, and still you're going to learn new things about it. Depending on what your level of fandom is, you're going to learn something new. And everything and anything you wanted to know about this show can be found in the pages of this book. So I want to thank you, Richard, for writing this book, and I want to thank you for your time and your candor today. And we can safely say that Married with Children fans all over the world want to collectively give you a big thank you for making us laugh all these years, and will continue to do so. And so we're wondering, do you have a message for your fans?
Just keep watching. Thank you for enjoying the work that we put out there. If it weren't for you, we wouldn't be in existence. And keep on watching. That's my message. And I hope in some way the book gives a little bit of closure that the final episode never did.
Yeah, I think it does. And yeah, that's a great motto, you know, just keep watching, keep going. This has been fun for us. So yeah, and I love reading the book. As I said, I mean, everything I said is true. I love reading it because, you know, I'm deep into the history of Married with Children and I'm learning stuff that I didn't know, which is always gives me a thrill. If I see footage that I've never seen before, whether it's in like a line from a promo that was footage that was never used or something like that, it gives me great joy, shall we say.
You're a great source. And, you know, I'm probably remiss in not having gone to you when I was writing the book. But I could give you some nuggets that you didn't have.
Ooh, yeah. No, well, I loved it. And Richard, I could talk to you all day, honestly, and it's been fantastic to speak with someone from the Married with Children world who does know it so well. And yeah, thank you again for your time today.
All right. Thank you, guys. Adios.
So thank you again, Richard. And thank you out there again for tuning in and listening to this very special episode of the Married with Children podcast. And we'd like to once again thank Mr. Richard Gurman for joining us and talking to us about his new book, Married with Children versus the World, the inside story of the shock-com that launched Fox and changed TV comedy forever. Get your copy now if you haven't already. And as for the Married with Children podcast, if we aren't able to get an interview like the one you just heard, we are happy to provide new content. Otherwise, we have all joined Alex at his 2/3-acre retirement property on Lake Chickamaucomico and hope you have enjoyed listening back on our old content. And we hope you will continue to tune in and relive the magic at the same Bundy time and the same Bundy channel.
Well, that about wraps it up here. Roll them out, boys. You know, Bundy, you're a decent guy, so here's a little tip from me to you. Don't die with your jewelry on, huh?